month on a baseball field in Detroit, an umpire blew a pitcher's perfect game by making a bad call in the ninth inning. The pitcher did not lose his temper. The umpire, after seeing the replay, admitted his error. His sincere apology to the pitcher and fans across America made national news. In this hour, we talk about what makes a successful apology. Joining me in the studio is Lauren Bloom. She's an attorney and author of a new book titled The Art of the Apology. Joining us from a studio at WBUR in Boston, Dr. Aaron Lazar. He's the author of the book titled On Apology. He's Chancellor Dean Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. And from the Radio Foundation in New York, Randy Cohen. He's author of The Ethicist column in the New York Times Magazine, which I happen to read every single week. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org and join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
Aaron, are you there? Good morning to you. And Randy Cohen, good morning to you.
I am. I'm here indeed. Good morning.
Good. Randy, does it seem to you that people are apologizing more often now than before?
No, quite the contrary. To acknowledge wrongdoing seems to occur less now, and as much because of attorneys as anyone. There seems to be a sense that if any a corporation, for example, acknowledges wrongdoing, they will be legally liable, so they'd rather dig their heels in. It's quite disheartening. I blame the lawyers. A good tactic in every part of life, by the way.
He's blaming the lawyers,
well,
Lauren.
Of course he is.
How do you see it?
Everyone blames the lawyers. Personally, I blame the MBAs. But I will say that he's absolutely right. That much of the
time...
No
one's ever said that before.
Well, this is a first then. You are absolutely right, Randy, that a lot of the time lawyers are trained not to let the other side have any concession. I mean, you know, we're taught from the moment we walk into law school that we never admit what we don't have to. And the problem is, one of the critical elements of making an effective apology is to take responsibility for what you've done.
Aaron, how do you see it? Are people apologizing more or less?
I have a different view. I've done a statistical analysis of the number of apologies that appeared in the Washington Post and the New York Times from 1900 till now. And there's been a threefold rise over the last 10 or 15 years. Now, how I agree with the other speakers are these apologies, 9 out of 10, are fraudulent, phony, insincere apologies that do no good. But they do. My study was how many times does the word apology appear in these papers? So I think there's a flood of apologies, but what's disheartening is that they're fraudulent.
Aaron, what are the basic motives for giving an apology from the studies you've done?
The motives, on a one-to-one basis, the genuine motives of feeling shame, feeling guilt, having an empathic connection with the other person. The more fraudulent one is, how do I get out of trouble? How do I get out of this suit? And how do I commit the con job? But what's striking to me is how transparent the fraudulent is.
How?
I mean, it's not hard. I can provide the analysis of what's gone wrong, but any reasonable person will say, this doesn't feel right to me. It's an awful apology. It's
all fraudulent. Right. Let's hear an apology, which I think the whole world has heard by now, and let you all give an assessment of it.
We're sorry for the massive disruption it's caused to their lives. And, you know, there's no one who wants this thing over more than I do. You know, I'd like my life back.
And, of course, that was BP CEO Tony Hayward. What did you think of that apology, Lauren?
Oh, it was dreadful. It's not about him. I expect Mr. Hayward was trying to sound empathetic, but he just sounded callous and selfish.
Randy, how did you feel about that apology?
Well, I disagree with Lauren slightly. She seems to be approaching this from the perspective of what will be most useful for the corporation. I'm sure he is sorry. I just think it's irrelevant. The test here is what follows in action. The apology must be a prelude to actually changing your behavior and making amends. And it remains to be seen whether BP will do that.
Aaron, what did you think of that apology?
When a person says, "I am sorry," and nothing else, that is not an apology. What about going to a house of mourning and say, "I'm so sorry for your loss"? Not an apology unless you accept responsibility for it. If he said, "We are so sorry what happened, we screwed up in effect, and now we have to make it right," that's an apology.
Randy, what do you think makes for a good apology?
Well, first, you acknowledge wrongdoing, and then you take action. That it can't be merely ritual theater. There's the phrase, "I take full responsibility." Well, Governor Sanford uttered that phrase, and then he just continued in office as if it were some magical incantation that cleanses all sin. You know, in Japan, 500 years ago, you would apologize, you would resign your post, you would commit suicide. I don't think Senator Ensign has even resigned. I don't think Senator Vitter has committed suicide, but I haven't seen the paper this morning.
Lauren, from your point of view as an attorney, if you think about protecting oneself legally, pardon me, but at the same time offering a sincere apology, what needs to be in there?
The truth is going to come out, and honestly, it should. If someone has done something genuinely wrong, the opposing counsel is probably going to be able to prove it. So as long as that's true, and particularly recognizing that relationships matter, you might as well admit the truth, take responsibility, and work proactively toward making amends right from the start. Litigation is a terrible way to solve problems.
Lauren Bloom, she's an attorney and the author of The Art of the Apology, How to Apologize Effectively to Practically Everyone. Dr. Aaron Lazar is a professor of psychiatry, Chancellor Dean Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. He's the author of On Apology. Randy Cohen writes the Ethicist Weekly column in the New York Times Magazine. His new play, The Punishing Blow, opens in New York in August. Do join us, 800-433-8850. I look forward to hearing your questions, your comments, your email about what you would regard as an effective apology and perhaps an example of one you have either given or received in recent years. Aaron, tell us how you did this empirical study of apologies.
Well, I agreed that as we look at apologies, there are three or four things that are critical. But as I studied thousands of apologies, I determined many, many more variables. And so I had several audiences of totaling 500 people and asked them, for an apology you received or wanted to receive, how important were each of these particular items? And I was able to collect about 15 items, somewhat overlapping, that were important. And some of them surprised me. For instance, one of the things that's important is the restoration of dignity. 80% of the people who filled it out said that was one of the most important things, which means that the offense in the apology, for the most part, are humiliations. Other things that I hadn't thought about specifically was people said, "I want a dialogue." And so if there's no dialogue, if a doctor, myself, goes up and makes a speech to a patient with the apology and walks out of the room, The best thing to do is to say, I'd like to come back tomorrow because you may have some other thoughts. So there are so many variables, and each apology has its own need because some things are so implicit. For instance, there has to be an acknowledgement of the offense. If you say, I'm so sorry for whatever I may have done or whatever I did, that's an insult. But how much detail you need depends on the situation. So apology turns out for me to be a pretty complex thing with different needs for each apology.
Randy Cohen, it strikes me that if someone says, I'm sorry if I offended you, it strikes me that that's not truly an apology. What do you think?
Oh, I completely agree. We have to beware of the non-apology, and the main thing to watch out for is the very word you used, if. If I've done wrong, or anything that shifts from our focus from our own actions to the response of the injured party, if I've offended you, or anything that focuses on intent, you know, I didn't mean to outrage everyone and put my career in jeopardy. Well, no, I'm sure not. But you hope nobody would find out that you are a horrible racist, Mr. Gibson. But we did find out, you know. And so, what, you know, in 2006, Mel Gibson apologized for drunken anti-Semitic outbursts. Whatever happened to that guy?
I just saw.
I believe he's moved on to drunken anti-black outbursts and misogynist outbursts, which is a kind of change, I suppose. But is it real reform?
Randy Cohen. He writes the Ethicist column in the New York Times Magazine. We'll be back for more examples of good and terrible apologies.
Good morning. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show on WAMU 88.5.
Coming up Monday on the Kojo Namdi Show, creatures some love and creatures some hate. First, the most sophisticated bloodsucker on the planet, the mosquito. Then, panda politics and elephant trails, creating a national zoo for the 21st century. The Kojo Namdi Show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU 88.5.
Mostly sunny skies today, a high in the low 90s. Right now, 86 degrees in northwest Washington. It's 10:19.
This broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
And here's our first email from Lee, and it just happens to be one of the examples we have. Lee says, so many apologies seem so phony. When Joe Barton apologized to BP, I felt he was sincere. When he apologized for apologizing, I thought it was simply politic. Let's hear Joe Barton in that apology for the apology.
Small point of personal privilege. I want the record to be absolutely clear that I think BP is responsible for this accident, should be held responsible, and should in every way do everything possible to make good on the consequences that have resulted from this accident. And if anything I've said this morning has been misconstrued in an opposite effect, I want to apologize for that misconstruction.
And Randy, you heard that big if in there.
Yeah, he put the big if in, and he said, if I was misconstrued. He wasn't misconstrued, he said previously. BP shouldn't be responsible. This is a slush fund. What Joe Barton should apologize for is being an idiot.
Go ahead, Laura.
For thinking that corporations or individuals, for that matter, are not responsible for their own actions.
Exactly.
He wasn't misconstrued. I'm sorry people correctly understood exactly what I said.
Well, I spent half my life being sorry for that. When you listen to his statement, what he said is not, I'm sorry. He said, I want the record to be clear. This was all about making sure that he didn't take too much political damage.
Exactly. And here's another email. Do you think Mel Gibson will get very far with a public apology this time? Aaron, what do you think?
I think when someone has a track record of making continuing to do stupid things, you've lost credibility. if you apologize for being late for a meeting and you're late all the time, people just laugh at you when you apologize for it.
The psychological importance to the recipient of a sincere apology is something you've looked into, Aaron.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
It's one of the most profound healing forces in nature. It has its early origins in prehistoric humans. It's part of all the religions in repentance. Even primates apologize, believe it or not, non-verbally. So these are profound healing things. And one of the most striking healing thing is the restoration of dignity and the resumption of a relationship.
And, Lauren, one of the things you talk about in your book, The Art of the Apology, is choosing your medium. Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, I know that the millennials among us may not agree with me, but never text an apology. I think it's important to think about, first of all, who you're going to talk to, how you're going to say it, but also whether you're going to talk in person, which is almost always the best way. The telephone is maybe next. Do you send a letter? Do you buy an apology card from Hallmark? They've done some very nice things, but I generally advise against those unless you add a personal note, because no matter how nice an apology card is, you didn't write it. But I think email and text are just a very bad way to try to apologize. They're too informal, they tend to be sloppy, and the subtext is, I didn't care enough to apologize in person.
How do you feel about that, Randy?
Well, I've been using hand puppets, so it's probably completely wrong. I hadn't really quite considered the media. I just wanted to distance myself from it a little because I screw up all the time, and I felt if I used the puppet, you know, I'm in the room, but I'm not, you know, it's my hand that did wrong. I think the rarest and most beautiful sentence in the English language is you were right and I was wrong. And it's a precious jewel. And when we get to hear it, we should treasure it. And we should occasionally actually utter that magical illusory phrase.
What about apologizing to strangers? If you've...
You mean at random?
Yeah, at random.
That's between you and your therapist, Diane.
No, I think it's really important. If I have somehow let the door fall because I didn't see that person behind me, I think it's really important to apologize to that person. Don't you think, Aaron?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Sure.
Randy, you think so. Aaron?
Oh, you bump into people and knock somebody over. These are strangers. Oh, an apology. If you say nothing, the implication is I meant it.
Oh, I agree. I think we live in a rough enough world as it is. Part of being civilized is to admit when you're wrong and say you're sorry.
You also have apologizing to yourself, Lauren.
That was an interesting chapter. A friend of mine suggested it when he read an early version of the book. And we together worked up a process that can sound a little artificial. But I think unless you're able to admit to your own humanity and work through the process of saying, okay, I blew it, I'm sorry, I'm going to try to do better, it's just that much harder to apologize to anyone else.
Okay, I want to get your assessment of this next apology.
But still, I know I have bitterly disappointed all of you. I have made you question who I am and how I could have done the things I did. I'm embarrassed that I have put you in this position. For all that I have done, I am so sorry.
And that, of course, was Tiger Woods. What did you think of his apology, Randy?
I thought it was interesting in that it falls into a kind of American Protestant tradition of sin, confession, redemption, repeat as needed, you know, that you go out Saturday night, you do terrible, terrible things. You go to church Sunday, you acknowledge them, you're accepted back into the bosom of the community, and then you repeat each week. You know, I'm Jewish and I just feel, you know, mortified all the time. But I observe that, so I don't have that weekly cleansing. But I observe that that seems deeply ingrained in a kind of American Protestantism, and tigers seemed an interesting manifestation of that.
How do you feel about it, Aaron?
The words itself, if I didn't know who it was, I'd say that could be part of a good apology. But the whole situation I thought was ridiculous. Putting his mother there, what a cruel thing to do. Organizing it on a day when there was a big golf meet there, and he took away the limelight from all of that, so and then he medicalizes it, and he said he has to go for treatment for his sexual activities. I thought the whole thing was terrible, but I think what you took out could be part of a good apology.
Because he said, "I'm embarrassed." That was part of a good apology, Lauren.
That was part of it. I think I am probably kinder to Tiger than a lot of the people who work in this field, in part because I've never thought he was especially articulate. This is not an actor. When Hugh Grant got up and apologized to America for having been an ass, he was charming and personable, and everybody loved him. That has never been Tiger Woods, so I don't really expect him to be able to be comfortable in that kind of setting. But I do think, in addition to everything Aaron has said about things that call the apology into question, it was terribly late. When this story first broke, he put that sad little statement up on his website, and I thought, all right, he's had an affair. But then one stiletto-heeled shoe after another just kept dropping and dropping, and every time that sad little statement looked just that much more inadequate.
All right, we're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850 to Welfare, Texas. Good morning, Peggy. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi.
I'm so grateful that you took my call. The doctor, I'm sorry I don't have his name, the doctor who spoke a while ago about medical malpractice suits addressed part of what I wanted to say. But I'm a retired RN, and I and many of my colleagues have believed for years that if doctors could find a way to acknowledge an error or an accident or a mistake and to the families of the injured person, the lawsuits would definitely drop in number. And I'll
All right. Aaron, do you want to comment? Aaron, are you there? Oh, dear. We seem to have lost Aaron. Go right ahead, Lauren.
I've looked at the research on this, and in fact, it is true. When doctors apologize, even for very severe mistakes that cause lasting injury and even death, families are much less likely to bring lawsuits, and when they do, the doctors are much less likely to be held liable. Now, that's not the best reason to do it. The best reason to make the apology is because the doctor has caused the injury. And I will say, I've read Aaron's book and I absolutely loved it. But he talked about the importance to the doctor-patient relationship.
Sure.
Of a doctor being able to say, I am human too, I made a mistake, and I am so sorry.
So if a doctor were able to say that, do you really believe a doctor could avoid a lawsuit if it's a serious mistake?
Oh, I know they can. Now, it's not just enough to say you're sorry. You also have to be willing to make amends. But the medical profession is well ahead of the business community on this. And the statistics do demonstrate that if doctors and hospitals work with patients and their families to come up with reasonable restitution, everyone walks away feeling a lot better, as they should. And incidentally, the hospitals spend a lot less money on lawyers.
All right, let's go to Keith in Arlington, Virginia. You're on the air.
Yes, it's my question had to do with the televangelist who was crying on the TV, and I have sinned. And I was curious whether your people actually thought that that was, you know, did that seem to them to be true? And 'cause I don't remember the gentleman ever saying what he did.
Randy.
I think that's a great example of that kind of the Protestant tradition in American life that I was referring to. It's very much a part of the evangelical tradition, different from Catholicism in that in Catholicism, confession is a private experience between the penitent and the priest. But in there's a wing of American Protestantism where you make a public acknowledgement of wrongdoing, and this was that. Unfortunately, what it's often accompanied by is the other American tradition, lather, rinse, repeat. I did not have the sense that it was that he was crying real tears. It put me in mind of that Betsy Wetsy doll my sister had when we were kids.
Yeah, I have to agree with Randy on this one. I thought it was just utterly over the top. And I think the fact that Reverend Swaggart hasn't really returned to public life is proof that America agreed with me.
And we're talking about apologies, good ones, bad ones, phony ones, real ones. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Vineyard Haven, Massachusetts. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning, Diane. I just wanted to throw something out there. Your show has gotten me thinking about young children, and I know that many of the schools in our area use a social curriculum that's called Responsive Classroom, and it covers many things, but an important piece of it is helping children learn how to apologize well. And it starts, depending on the age of the kids, helping them learn how to express an apology, teaching them about the importance of apology of action, helping them problem solve when they've made a mistake, what kind of action might fix whatever, whether it was a hurt feeling, whether it was, you know, physical harm or breaking a toy. They learn the importance of giving the person who's been hurt to say how it made them feel. And they also, I think, kids need to understand and have to learn that an apology needs to happen even if they didn't mean to make the mistake.
Aaron, what do you think? Is teaching children how to apologize and the importance of apologies something that should be part of a curriculum?
Well, from background, my wife and I had adopted 8 children, 7 of whom were teenagers at the same time. So I've been working on this personally.
Wow. I'm impressed.
But it's just to teach them, the worst outcome is saying, sorry. But I think learning the dynamics and the processes are important. And the other most important thing is for the parent to apologize to the child to show
yes.
This is not a terrible thing.
Yes.
But I think it's a wonderful thing to work at, but it requires a lot of thought and patience.
Takes a lot of courage on the part of a parent to say to a child, Lauren, I'm sorry.
It does, but it shouldn't. You know, Aaron, I've just discovered we have something in common. My 2 daughters are adopted from Kazakhstan. And my eldest has only been in the country for 6 months. And she's already figured out that if she says the most terrible things to her in the world to her sister and then says, Sally, she's supposed to be off the hook. So, of course, we don't do that in our house. But I make it a rule when I make mistakes to tell the kids I'm sorry. Because I got to tell you, they know I've done it. And as long as that's true, they think more of me and respect me more when I'm honest about it than when I try to pretend to be more perfect than I am.
Exactly. All right. Thanks for calling. And let's now go to Lake Worth, Florida. Good morning, Marty. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
Thought you folks might find this interesting. In 1907, in the middle of the Gobi Desert, in a oasis town called Tun Huang, an explorer by the name of Oral Stein came across one of the great discoveries in the world, which was approximately 1,000-year-old walled-up library of Buddhist scrolls, very well known in that particular area of knowledge. At any rate, one of the curiosities to emerge from this archive is a 1,000-year-old model letter of apology in Chinese designed for inebriated guests to send to their hosts. And it translates as this. Yesterday, having drunk too much, I was so intoxicated as to pass all bounds, but none of the rude or coarse language I used was uttered in a conscious state. The next morning, after hearing others speak on the subject, I realized what had happened, whereupon I was overwhelmed with confusion and ready to sink into the ground with shame. Now, the letter follows on that the writer will soon come to apologize in person for his transgression.
It sounds as though that's worthy of a column in the New York Times, Randy.
Oh, yeah, I was jotting that down so I could steal it. for which I will apologize, of course, and mean it.
Randy Cohen, he writes the Ethicist Weekly column in the New York Times Magazine. More apologies from all over after a short break.
Good morning. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show on WAMU 88.5. A Prairie Home Companion is coming up next at 11. And then at 2, join Bob Edwards for a conversation with singer-songwriter Paul Thorne. That's on Bob Edwards Weekend at 2.
This week on Interfaith Voices, we explore black preaching in America.
You can hear the drumming, the chanting that we brought with us from Africa, and it's not anything that we've ever tried to get rid of.
I'm Maureen Fiedler. Black Preaching as a Liberation Art Form. That's Sunday afternoon on Interfaith Voices.
Today at 3 on WAMU 88.5.
87 degrees in Northwest Washington. It's 10:38.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
And we'll go right back to the phones to Detroit, Michigan. Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane. I am a huge fan of yours, and I'm very grateful for your taking my call this
morning.
Thank you. Also a very big fan of Randy Cohen. My comment is that it strikes me how similar the conversation has been to the need for the humility that is required in 12-step programs to own one's actions and take responsibility and to make amends, and to do so whenever possible, as long as it does not create additional harm. I think this is such an important part of what is missing in our society generally, politically, and in the absence of social conscience among corporations, as your conversation has demonstrated. But I'm very struck by this and the importance of various 12-step programs, and their success for individuals depends greatly upon a person's ability to make apology, and
right.
It does require taking action.
Absolutely. Leslie, thanks for that. Aaron, what has happened to the art of the apology? Why have we gotten away from it? I understand the legal ramifications, but I'm troubled by the fact that people have a really, really hard time saying, I'm sorry, I was wrong, I apologize.
I've done studies of, at least of medical students, and asked them why it's so hard. I'll be vulnerable. People will see that I'm weak. They'll know for the first time what I did. So these are the normal things. Well, what is happening now is a different phenomena. There's this wave of apologies, really. The newspapers are full of it. One interesting observation that I'm sure I'm right about is that if someone makes a good public apology, a really terrific one, it's in the paper for only a day. But if someone really has a terrible one, like most of these legislators who get in trouble, the newspapers milk it, and it's in there for days and days and weeks.
And here's an example of one that certainly played out over a long period of time.
My wife, Regina, she has been horribly hurt by my behavior. And when something happens like that, if you hurt a person, and it's your responsibility, you try to fix it. And at that point, there's only two things that can happen. Either you're going to make some progress and get it fixed, or you're going to fall short and perhaps not get it fixed. So let me tell you, folks, I got my work cut out for me.
And Randy Cohen, David Letterman, certainly implied that he was sorry. Was he successful?
Full disclosure, I worked for Dave for 7 years. I used to write for the show. And my impression was that he lives in a moral universe, that he's far from a perfect person, as all of us are, but he has a sense of right and wrong, and I have no inside information about what went on with this. Is long after I left the show, but I believed him. I think he regretted what he did. I think he sees the effect of his actions on other people, which is the essence of ethical conduct, not how it affects you directly, but how what you do affects others. And I think he was going to try to make it right, although our view of it was colored because he was himself the victim of an extortionist, and one was inclined to be a bit more sympathetic.
Lauren?
I agree, and I think this was in many ways an apology to his audience. One of the things that the American public wants from its public figures is that humility that your previous caller talked about. And he demonstrated that. He was telling the public that he was going to try to make it up with his wife, which is very important to Americans. But the other thing that I think helps a lot is David Letterman has never pretended to be perfect. We all know he's human. We've watched him for years. You love him or you don't, but he's very honest about who he is. So, yes, I believed him, too. I thought he was sincere.
How about you, Aaron?
As was said, you love him or you don't. I don't love him. And I felt like he was bragging. It was like he was waving it about rather than sounding really humbled by it.
So how would you have changed what he said, or was it the very fact that he is a public figure on late-night television? Could he have said anything, Aaron, that would have made you believe he was sorry?
Yeah. In my research, one of the most important things in people receiving an apology is, do they perceive it as sincere, which is a very subjective thing. And so I could understand that 50 or 70% of the population thought it was sincere. I didn't. I thought it was manipulative.
Benjamin has sent us an email saying, for an apology to make a difference, you have to make it clear that you understand how I felt because of your actions. I want to know you see me. What do you think of that, Aaron?
That's ranks amongst the highest of things that people want. That's if you don't understand me, if you don't understand what you did to me, how can you really apologize? So I think it's a profound statement.
All right. And to Silver Spring, Maryland. Good morning, Debbie.
Good morning. First of all, thank you so much for taking my call. I was just really struck by this conversation. I come across people both in my professional life as a school teacher and in my personal life of people that just are not able to articulate the phrase, I'm sorry. And I find myself getting frustrated. I was just curious what the panelists thought about that. I mean, what makes it so difficult for people, even people that I have a sense recognize that they made a mistake?
But Lauren.
I think it's two things. I think, one, it's very hard to admit to being human. I don't know why, because we all are, but I think it can be very hard to admit to being human. You know, as Aaron was saying, the medical students who don't want to be seen, who don't want to be have their shortcomings public. But the other thing is, I think as a culture, we've become very punitive. And there's a lot of consequence to admitting to error a lot of the time. And I think people are very frightened that if they once admit that they've done something wrong, they're going to pay a horribly high price for that.
All right.
May I add something?
Surely.
I think there's also the risk that the fear of losing credibility. As a parent, as you were referring to previously, if you acknowledge error, then will this undermine your entire parental credibility? Politicians, if a politician goes, oh, I was wrong about this policy, I'm now changing my mind, that's not considered, oh, how admirable, you've rethought something. You will be branded a flip-flopper. Every now and then, I know this will shock you, Diane, I feel I get a question wrong in the column. And the furious email of the readers sometimes persuades me. And so about once a year, I'll go back and revisit a question, acknowledge that I got it wrong, and try to provide a better answer. The first time I did this, I was really frightened for that reason, that I would lose credibility, that for the rest of the life of the column, people would go, oh, yeah, the way you did that time about sneaking food into the movies. Why should we believe anything you said?
Yeah.
But the effect was quite the opposite. Rather than requiring courage, it turned out people praised me for this, as if there were some physical danger involved.
Yeah,
and I think it gave me more credibility.
That's quite an experience. Let's go now to Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, Bernie.
Hello. Hi, Diane. Hello, everybody. Making an apology at the spur of the moment when you know that you've done something wrong, I mean, and everybody knows it. Okay, for example, I'm a 55-year-old singer in a rock and roll band, and I know that sounds like that's pretty embarrassing in itself. But there's an unwritten rule between singers. Singers don't tell other singers how to sing. So I did this in practice one night, and Jimmy, I know you're listening out there, and I'm going to use the national airwaves to do this. I do apologize for stepping over the line and stepping into your world. You're a good singer, and I do want you to accept my apology. How was that?
Now, that's interesting, making this apology over an internationally broadcast program. How does that sit with you, Aaron, rather than apologizing face-to-face with Jimmy, whom Bernie has apparently offended?
Well, I think he ought to do it both ways. You should do it directly, but I suppose he's exposing himself even further to tell the whole world that that he messed up.
How do you react, Randy?
Well, I happen to have Jimmy right here, so let him speak.
I think this, just listening.
Oh, no, my friend. It looks like a handgun. It's probably just, you know, a cigarette lighter. Bad enough. I think Aaron's got it right here. It's an interesting public display, and in a way, it there's a taint of bragging about it. It has the form of humility, but does it have the content of being self-serving that demonstrates what a splendid fellow you are? I think both Aaron and Lauren were right when they said this should be done face to face.
Face to face.
Microphone to microphone.
All right, Bernie.
Country ballad to country ballad.
Next step.
And Bernie, you may now have to apologize again for putting him in a position where if he doesn't accept your apology, he looks like a bum.
That's exactly right. All right.
It's like proposing at Yankee Stadium on the billboard.
Exactly.
How can you say no?
And maybe it was missing a key element. How he is going to correct his mistake. He's never going to do that again. That would help, too.
And cash, I find.
And cash, yeah.
It's making amends. Here's $5. Buy yourself something pretty.
I'd like you all to hear what I consider really a wonderful apology.
I know that some people wonder whether nearly 40 years on from an event, a Prime Minister needs to issue an apology. For someone of my generation, Bloody Sunday and the early 1970s are something we feel we have learnt about rather than lived through. But what happened should never, ever have happened. The families of those who died should not have had to live with the pain and the hurt of that day and with a lifetime of loss. Some members of our armed forces acted wrongly. The government is ultimately responsible for the conduct of the armed forces, and for that, on behalf of the government, indeed on behalf of our country, I am deeply sorry.
And, of course, that was British Prime Minister David Cameron apologizing for the killing by British soldiers of Irish citizens on Bloody Sunday. Aaron, how did you feel about that apology?
Almost in tears. I thought it was profound. He talks about the detail of the offense. There is no, we're sorry for whatever happened, but he says what happened. And it was similar, I thought, to the Aborigines' apologies from Australia. Something very moving about these, with the details of the hurt that people went through.
How did you feel, Randy?
I agree. And that what's embodied in this is a determination to change policy. Prime Minister Cameron's in a position to make that kind of change. So that's quite significant. And it reflects a kind of continuity of government, that although he himself was not in office when these events took place, the government continues. And it almost personifies the government. And he acknowledges wrongdoing and will act to improve conduct now.
Laura.
I agree. And I love his use of very direct language. One of the mistakes companies make is to say, we regret any inconvenience, just to say, I am sorry is definitely the way to go. I thought it was brilliant.
And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Now to Crown Point, Indiana. Good morning, Dick.
Hi. I've got a problem with Toyota, and I don't want to really dump on them because I like the cars I have, but I have two cars that I'm associated with that have a problem which involves a broken spot weld, which will require them to re-weld the car and paint it, the driver's door. And the first of these belongs to my son, and we're having, I'm probably going to end up paying for that myself. The point is, I bought these cars because of my perception of reliability, and I'm having more trouble with these two cars than I've had with a lot of cars I've had in the past. And has had unique problems.
So what do you want from Toyota?
Well, I'd like to talk to somebody at Toyota who has some... All I talk to is gatekeepers, and basically I'm having problems here.
Yeah.
Hold on. I have... all I can do is talk to their gatekeepers, and, they act like a typical car company. It's not their problem, and, you know, the car is out of warranty and that type of thing. In my opinion, it should be a recall as opposed to the system they set up for it.
All right, Randy, as the ethicist, what do you think Toyota ought to be doing?
Well, first I want to thank him for calling Car Talk. We love these kind of questions here. You know, I have no idea. I haven't seen the cars. Even if I looked at the cars, I can barely identify which object is a car. They're the things with the four wheels, I gather. I live in a city. I ride my bike. I don't know. I have no idea. Did they do wrong? Did you do wrong? Toyota, they're from Japan. I defer to the more automotively inclined here.
Aaron, what do you think?
Well, I think we have to assume that they did wrong. If they didn't, then there's no apology. But if they did, apology has to come with reparation. Otherwise,
Of course, they have had these massive recalls of various cars. Have you heard them say, I'm sorry, Lauren?
Recently, yes. I think Toyota was late to the party. Certainly, they've recently done ads apologizing for failing in quality. You know, ultimately, what this comes down to is, for any business, it's important for customers to have someone with authority to do something there, to listen to complaints, make apologies, and make appropriate amends. I don't know if there's a problem with the spot welds on these cars. I am no more mechanically inclined than Randy. But I do know that it's just bad service not to talk to your customers.
And the same goes for your dearest friend, your next-door neighbor, the person across the street. When you've done something wrong, say, I'm sorry. Lauren Bloom, Aaron Lazar, Randy Cohen, thank you all so much.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Dori Annisman answers the phones.
Welcome to The Global Guru. I'm Megan Nesmith, in for Rachel Louise Snyder. Each week, we ask one simple question, just one, about somewhere in the world. Today, we're in Arizona asking the Hopi, how do you bring rain to the desert?
Imagine, if you would, a human figure with different types of headdresses on and different markings on the body.
This is Bruce McGee from Phoenix's Heard Museum. He grew up on a Hopi reservation, and he's telling me about Katsina dolls, which are more talisman than toy. To understand, he takes me back to the land.
The actual Katsina spirits live in the San Francisco Peaks, near Flagstaff.
These mountain spirits dance in the bodies of Hopi men during ceremonies. They're celebrated as life givers and teachers. The Katsina dolls are then carved versions of these dancing spirits. They're made from the roots of cottonwood trees.
The root brings life to the tree. The Katsinas bring life to the Hopis.
McGee says Katsina is an anglicized version of Tihu, the Hopi word for life. And in the desert, life means rain.
Katsinas bring a certain addition to life, recognizing the need for rain, thanksgiving for rain, healing powers.
There are over 250 Katsina spirits, including one he calls the eagle.
When he comes out, it's a beautiful thing. It has a full length of feathers across each arm, has a beautiful eagle headdress. He is the mediator between man and the creator. He also has a stewardship of watching over Mother Earth.
Carved Katsina dolls like the eagle are a thriving art trade. One doll sells in the shop for $27,000. Still, they're sacred to the Hopi, who give them to young girls to teach them about their culture. The hope is that the dolls will inspire virtues like wisdom and friendship. In the museum, McGee shows me one about teamwork.
They call him Kuyemsi. In this case, the Kuyemsi can walk, but he's blind. The other one is paralyzed. In order for the two to survive, the one carries the other. So what does that tell you and I? We can't do it by ourselves.
Another, called White Bear, has a red muzzle full of sharp teeth.
Here he's showing his authority. He has the bow in one hand, a rattle in the other. Others will have evergreen sometimes around the neck, and that reflects the idea that life is eternal. It goes on.
To McGee, the Hopi Katsina dolls are eternal too, more than just tree roots and desert rain.
I call the Katsinas books in wood because they each tell a story.